This past weekend, I had the privilege of interviewing Kristen Schedul about her new book that will be out in a few months called Losing the Way. Her book is frank and honest. She tells of her life, the good, the bad, and the lockbox. Many have had similar journeys, and Kristen exposes the lockbox for what it is. This is a book that will be a light for many who have traveled a similar path. The shame and guilt of carrying a secret. Tonight we're going to discuss some of the early years in the way. So, what prompted you to write the book?
What prompted me to write the book? Well, I guess healing. I just needed to process what had happened, and I needed to heal from the trauma of it all and make sense of it. Because when I left, it was just I'd lost meaning to everything.
Right.
You know, meaning in my life, meaning to the universe, meaning with the only thing that gave me meaning were my kids, and I felt like I needed to have something independent of them.
Mm-hmm.
So writing was really a great tool to sift through what had happened. So I think it was desperation that led me to write the book more than anything.
How long have you been working on the book?
Oh, well, about 20 years.
20 years, okay.
It was It was actually, this is the fourth version. I wrote two fictionalized versions.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing a memoir back in the 90s, and it got picked up pretty quickly, and they were like, oh, well, this is going to be, like, really sensational. And I was like, no, forget it. I'm just kidding, you know? So I put that aside, and then this time just seemed the right time, and it really flowed. It wasn't a hard write.
Yeah.
At first.
Now, you left, like, about 85, 86, something like that?
85, yeah.
85. So that was before all the... So Werewolf was still alive at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right before he died. Actually, I left in January or February, and he died in, what, May?
Mm-hmm.
I think. Yeah, so I missed all the patriarch passing stuff and all the brouhaha that happened after that.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Now, one of the... I mean, there's a couple of threads that go through the whole book and in your life, one of which was this kind of feeling of loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
It seems consistent in the book anyway, that was a recurring thing in your life.
Well, just, I think any adolescent, you know, the need to belong is really strong, but mine started, I think my family of origin was very intellectual and creative, and everybody was sort of in their own little world, and I was looking for a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when I found the family of the way, it still didn't reach that deep hole inside.
Right.
So it wasn't a recurring theme, but I think that when I finally in the end figured out that A, it has to start with me, and B, my family maybe isn't perfect, but they're still my family.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real turning point for me.
Now, you had, going back like to the beginning of the book, you were 14 when you first got involved?
Right.
Now, about what year was that? Was that like 71, 72?
1970.
70, okay. That was a few years before I got on board.
Yeah, it had spread up to Rhode Island and Massachusetts and Exeter and New Hampshire and all that.
Coming out of the 60s where there was all this, you know, the Love Generation and hope for a change, and then all the, you know, the people that got assassinated and disillusionment became a big part of adding to the search for some kind of sense of belonging or sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you? I know you were a little bit younger, but...
Well, it's funny. My oldest brother had gotten into TM at the University of Chicago, and he came home and, you know, with a meditation mat and the tingling bells and everything. And I remember, where I must have been about 12, but I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm not going to go to this Eastern religion stuff until I reject the Western religion. So I have to know about the Western religion stuff. So maybe I was 13. But anyway, I was getting into pot and, you know, partying, and my parents weren't very strict, and so
right.
They just kind of let me run wild, and I think that I needed to impose some kind of stopgap, some structure, and I was just following what the big kids were doing at that point. But as far as the meaning went, you know, I was wondering, well, what's the purpose of the universe, and what are we here for, and those questions that any 13 or 14-year-old asks themselves. And
right.
So it all just kind of dovetailed the way it came along at the perfect time for me.
Give me a little background on the whole, this groovy Christian crowd that was in Rye, and also, I think there was a big movement going on in Long Island, if I recall right, also at
right.
that time. What people were like and what kind of atmosphere you were in?
Well, it was really exciting. I think what I say in the book is it was like riding the crest of a tsunami. You
yes.
know? I mean, it
yeah.
was just unbelievable energy, and we felt like we'd found the way. We'd found it. I remember coming home to my mother and just saying, you know, I've found the answer, Mom. You know, you don't have to worry anymore. And so. I think we were all just so taken up with what we perceived to be the truth, and I had no doubts about it at that point. I was just fully engaged, and I think that the music, there were people that were into rock and roll, and they changed it into Christian music, and that was what, like 30 years ago or more?
Right.
And now we have the new evangelicals that are doing that same kind of thing. And so it seemed like we were forging the way into some spiritual wilderness, and it was very exciting.
Yeah, definitely was. The turning point was going to see this DJ. You're going to have to go with the names, because I figured out who some of them are. So.
Yeah, Barry Norman.
Barry Norman, thank you.
Yeah.
He was a pretty popular DJ in the New York City area, from
right.
what I've heard.
Very charismatic.
Yes. Now, you start in your book about going to see him, and of course, telling your dad where to go because he doesn't want you to go.
Right.
And I can
from his fever. Yeah.
Oh, I can so identify with that, you know.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. What was it like going and meeting this guy and, you know, all your friends? You had, like, probably, what, 5 or 10 people going with you to go visit this guy?
Well, again, it was like going to Oz. It was so exciting. And at first I was kind of a tag along. I didn't know what I was getting into. But once we got there, he was so, so charismatic and so open. I'd never heard anyone talk about their lives as frankly as he did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my family was pretty, like, not secretive, but just like, it's nobody else's business how
right.
screwed up we are. So I was just, I was aghast that he would talk about adultery and things, sins that he'd committed, and how the Lord had saved him.
Mm-hmm.
And here I had just, you know, told my father where to go, and I thought, well, I guess I need saving too.
One of the things I enjoyed was that how dramatic a change happened. Even before the PFAL class, before you started taking that, there was kind of this lightness coming out, and people were exuberant and that. Was it a dramatic change?
Oh, yeah. Well, we used to party every night over at John Pope's house, and it was like the hippie commune, you know, the whole house was open and everybody would go there and party, and my parents didn't know what I was doing, but they figured, you know, well, as long as she's not dead, everything's fine. And so suddenly those parties turned into Bible meetings every single night. And we'd be sitting around with our little open Bibles, and the leaders would, well, the leaders, I guess it was Laura had brought the word to us, and she would be expounding as well as she could. It just turned into, like, you know, we felt like we were the first century church all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And blazing the trail. And I, you know, frankly, I think I was so excited to be part of the group and to be part of this new movement that seemed to have answers to war and answers to drugs and alternatives to sex and violence. It just seemed like it was safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd finally found my safe family. And I think that's where the incredible betrayal eventually happens. I don't want to, you know, give the whole story away, although everybody knows what the story is. Anybody that lived through the way knows. You know, it started out so too good to be true. Have you ever heard that quote by Jeannie Mills? She was part of Jonestown.
Mm-mm.
She had left right before the mass suicide, and she went back to San Francisco and started advocating against cults. And she said that the essence of it was that if you meet a group of people that are the most loving and incredible people, and then you meet the leader who's the most charismatic and compassionate person, and they stand for something that's beyond your wildest dreams, and it seems too good to be true, well, it probably is too good to be true.
Yeah, yeah.
She was actually murdered 3 years later, and nobody ever solved that murder.
Wow.
But I love that quote because it's so painfully true that it was too good to be true.
One quote you had at the beginning, what terrifies me more than anything else is rejection.
Uh-huh.
Was that a lifelong thing?
Yeah, I'd say sure, from pretty early on. Because again, you know, I didn't get the warm fuzzies at home, and so I think I grew up feeling rejected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with an alcoholic father, and I was pretty vulnerable, so I was fresh for the catch, or as they say,
mm-hmm.
ripe.
Something that was interesting when I think it was Barry Norman that did the thing about sin is in the blood, and that
mm-hmm.
whole, that very early on you saw that there's an out for anything you do wrong.
Right. The age of grace.
Yes.
Yeah. But in my, you know, my young, naive, kind of, I would say, innocent mind, I mean, I'd been exposed to a lot, but deep down I was still pretty gullible, and so I would go along with what people were saying without thinking it through. And to me, grace just meant God's love, you know, and that I wasn't going to take advantage of that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that just didn't seem... That wasn't, to me, that's not what they were saying at that point. It was pure to me. It was very pure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't see any double messages or anything like that.
But then at some point, those pure messages and things like that ended up having double meanings and,
right.
and that's one thing that I really got from reading the book was that in many ways, people were set up for all the things that did happen.
Right. And I think that's part of why it was a cult,
mm-hmm.
because there was that deception. You know, people say, well, it was just a nice little Bible fellowship or a, you know, religious movement, but what distinguishes a cult from other movements is the use of mind control. And that deception certainly was, you know, there's like this inner core to the core of the way. There was like this secret society that was there,
mm-hmm.
that where there were all these double meanings and innuendos, and so things weren't what they appeared to be.
Right. The tape will self-destruct, and we will disavow any knowledge of you and your team. I love the Mission Impossible thing when you're finally taking the PFL class for the first time. What was the atmosphere like? What with people finally getting to hear this class that they've probably heard about?
Well, again, it was very electric, and we were sitting on the floor of this old barn on this tattered rug, and with the tape recorder going squeaking around in the middle of the room on a one of those thimble things that those big tables or that people turn into tables.
Oh, yeah. The cable thimble,
yeah. So it was, you know, every night. And I didn't even think to ask questions. They'd say, write them down, and, you know, you're not supposed to ask questions. But the only question I could come up with was, well, what about all the people that don't believe this, and are they going to hell? But that never got answered.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, again, being swept up into this force that was bigger than us.
Yeah, probably at that point, you weren't even aware of what that class and a few other classes in New York and California were doing, was starting this whole revolution.
Right. No, not at all. So, you know, there were 12 of us in the class, so of course we thought of ourselves as the 12, original 12, and and when we spoke in tongues, that was the proof. And although I was very dubious about whether I did speak in tongues, I was sure I was going to be rejected by God, you know. I was so, like, paranoid. So, but it happened, I guess.
Yeah, I think everybody went through that.
Right.
You know, what's going to happen if I don't?
Mm-hmm.
So you've taken this class now. What time of the year was that?
That was in the summer.
In the summer, okay.
1970, yeah.
And then in October, I guess, of that year, Dr. Werwell is making a visit to Rye.
Right.
What was the atmosphere like with that? You know, I mean, it must have... I'm sure it was causing a stir.
Yeah. Well, I went down the main street in the town where, you know, of Rye, and I put up little posters and things inviting everyone to this meeting of the man of God of the world. I had no shame. I was completely, like, you know, swept up in it. So come to the Rye Presbyterian Church and hear the man of God. And I don't know why people let me put them in their windows, but they did. And I passed out flyers to people on the street shamelessly. And it kind of mortifies me now. If I saw a teenager doing that, I'd want to take them by the arm and say, come on, let's go get a Coke, you know? Let's talk for a minute.
Why aren't you doing drugs like every other teen?
Yeah, right. You know? What's your problem? But it was, you know, for me, it was like seeing the Wizard of Oz. I mean, he'd come to our town, and he came on a motorcycle, which was so cool, and there was his assistant, and they were just looking like Jimmy Dean with the Bible, you know. it was too cool.
I love your line about the Wizard of Oz and cowboy boots.
Yeah. Right. I was going to say, to me, he was like the father, you know, the father that I'd always longed for. And he just stepped right into those shoes.
So what kind of thoughts were going through your head when he pulled up on the motorcycles, which was probably a shock in and of itself?
Well, boy, what thoughts were going through my head? I don't think any thoughts were going through my head. I was just so so excited. I couldn't be thinking at that point as a young person. You know, just here's like the next thing to Jesus, the prophet, the teacher, capital T.
And so he did a meeting. Was it that? No, I think it was the following year, the one that your mother went to, if I remember right. Yeah. Now, your family was very, I mean, from the descriptions you give of your mom, you know, she was open-minded and really was a great believer in critical thinking.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden you're just buying something hook, line, and sinker.
It was a great way to rebel, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can imagine
I tried to rebel every single way, which, you know, through any way that I could, whether it was through drugs or sex or alcohol. And every time I'd come home and say, well, I just did this, they'd one-up me. You know, like, it's kind of like, wait a minute, you know, I got to do something that's going to really blow your mind.
Yeah.
So I think on an unconscious level, this was going on for me. Yeah, and it really did the did the trick. But they never put their feet down and said, you can't go,
mm-hmm.
because they knew me, that I'd find a way to go anyway. But they were, my mom especially was involved in coming to a meeting, and she didn't want to sit through the class, even though one of her friends did. Mrs. Potter down the street had sat through the class, and mom was, they were in the same women's consciousness raising group, and mom was just like, no way, I'm not shelling out $40 for a class to listen to some guy brainwash me with the Bible.
Right. Yeah, it was funny because your mother was asking questions that to anybody outside the group seemed absolutely normal and logical.
Right.
And you, of course, were, you know, had already pretty much lost any kind of critical thinking you would have had.
Yeah.
And bought everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an interesting observation about your mom. And as, you know, most parents of people that took the class were like that, too. And we bought it. We bought the whole thing.
I think it's one of the dilemmas of parents of kids that get involved with groups like this, I mean, especially kids that are very idealistic and intelligent, relatively speaking, you know, that are educated, and suddenly they just turn off that critical apparatus. And how do parents reach that, you know, reach their children after that? And I think all of us know how hard it is.
And in the I guess he did teaching from the Old Testament or something like that. You were talking about, he was talking about, why sit we here till we die?
Right, with the lepers.
Yeah.
Outside the gate. Yeah, I don't remember where that is, fortunately.
He had stumbled upon what would become a gold mine for him,
mm-hmm.
of the disenfranchised youth.
Right.
And you guys are having the time of your lives, and you're going to be in magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Did that stuff kind of start going to your head, or?
Well, I was always trying to witness to these people. You know, they were just unsaved unbelievers.
Right.
And so, again, I think I was still too young to understand, well, this is like Life magazine and Time magazine, and they were hauling us into the city to give interviews on radio. And I remember somebody asking me about the devil, and I was like, is everything evil caused by the devil? And I was like, well, of course it is, you know, just giving really obvious Bible answers without understanding who I was talking to.
Right.
So the glamour, it was only after it was published, after they were published, and then I started getting some weird vibes from the believers that I thought, you know, and people started writing me letters that I didn't, you know, strangers would write me letters and tell me that they, you know, were saved and loved me and weird stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I started getting the hint then. When I was away at prep school, somebody came up to me with a Cosmopolitan magazine and said, did you know that you're in Cosmo? I said, no. And they'd done an article on cults. There was my picture.
Really?
I looked like a total crazed lunatic in the picture, but it was still, you know, they kind of had taken on a life of its own. So the answer to your question is, did it go to my head? I don't think so, but I think it worried me because I didn't want it to go to my head.
Right. And,
you know, the sin of pride and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have been an exciting time there. You know, just as, yeah. You know, being the focal point of attention on
yeah.
on what you consider rebelling, and it's like, and things like Life magazine are buying into it.
You know? Right. It's like, wait a minute, you know, I want to do something really bad here. But yeah, so when they, I remember when they came to interview my parents, that was a, it was a really bad stormy night, and I was still just trying to witness to the interviewer, and my parents were, she would ask them questions and they'd try to get a word in edgewise. Like, well, take the class, that's the answer to everything.
Right. It was so simple back then, wasn't it?
It was so simple, yes, and that was part of the seduction of it.
Now, shortly after that, you got to go to headquarters for the first time.
Right.
The busload of New Yorkers. All I can picture is, all I can picture is John Pope driving the bus. But
no, I don't think he did. I think somebody else did. But we sang a lot. We sang in the bus. Good old Bible tunes, way tunes.
So, what was it like for a New Yorker to visit corn country?
Oh boy. Well, again, it was like, I just keep comparing it to Dorothy and Oz. It was so foreign, but to me, that was like it. You know, this was where the heartbeat of God was emanating from, and my parents were like, New Knoxville, Ohio? You want to do what? No, this is where Nirvana is, you know?
I was so disappointed when I found out that the Wizard was from Emporia, Kansas. I was just, I was going, no, don't wreck that for me. It's a great movie, you know.
It was perfect when I found it.
Yeah.
It was like figures.
Yeah. Now, another thing happens. You get to really talk to Dr. Werewell at one point when he's out shoveling the snow, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And You ask him a question about how to love God, and then all of a sudden the next night he's got the answer in a teaching.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been special to you.
I felt pretty powerful at that.
Yeah.
I felt like the woman from Samaria, you know, meeting Jesus at the well, and so he does this big teaching on it. Yeah. So that started a kind of a special connection, I think, or what I perceived as special. And I think the thing that was overriding is how sincere everyone was. I mean, I felt like the doctor was so sincere, and the other believers were so sincere, and Barry Norman and all of our, everyone was, there was just this incredible purity. And that the doctor took me seriously, and I was just this little dweeb from Rye, New York. That was amazing to me.
And you, at this point, you're only like, what, 15?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. So moving ahead a little, he comes back to Rye.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where your first contact with Dr. Werewell happens.
Mm-hmm.
I know you... In the book, you of course kind of justify what he's doing when he pats you on the rear.
Yeah.
What were the thoughts going through your head at the time, and you know how you felt about that?
Well, that was a little weird. You know, it felt like he'd done something that no male elderly figure had ever done before. I mean, even my father wouldn't do something like that.
And right.
So I thought, well, that was a little weird, but he's a man of God, so, and he's from Ohio, so maybe that's what they do out there. I don't know. It didn't really register as like, oh my God, how could he do that? It was just, you know, being a little rude. But I couldn't reconcile that with him and love and everything that he said, so I just took the high road in my mind and justified it.
Now, how did you get invited to ride on the coach, the RV, to that meeting that night?
I don't know. I guess I really don't know. I guess because I had been in the magazine, and they were going to this fancy country club, and they just wanted me along. And maybe because his daughter was there at that point, and she was very involved and smiling and friendly, so we became friends mm-hmm. at that point. So maybe it was also to keep her company and just hang out. I think the doctor thought at some point that I would be a good influence on her. Yeah. Well, I thought she was being a good influence on me because she was so, you know, she was in. She was the man's daughter. So it was a mutual admiration society.
Yeah, just I found from the first, I think the first time I met Dr. Worrell or saw him face to face was at a Rock of Ages, 73, I think. Mm-hmm. And wearing this, just, I mean, he had the worst advice on clothing. That's, you know, I mean, he just, you know, he kept the polyester market going, I think.
I loved his white knee-high socks.
Yeah, though, oh, yeah, yeah. I know. Yes. And that's another thing about the book is that you'd observe these little things that you just go, that's right, he did wear those knee-highs. But my first impression of him when I met him was that he's a shyster.
Really?
Yeah, my absolute... Oh. Yeah, I was watching, he was standing, there was somebody playing on the stage, I think it was Ted Farrell, mm-hmm. and he was married at the time, Marla or...
Right,
Marcia. Yeah. And he's just looking around, and he just had this, to me, it was just this kind of lecherous look as he's looking over the crowd. And
How old were you at that time?
I was 20, 21, 20.
So you had some objectivity. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, that never crossed my mind.
Yeah, it just, I think, I was talking with somebody else about this. I think guys could catch on to looks that other guys give to women and mm-hmm. things like that. And it just seems to be something that guys can see that girls can't see. Hmm. And because I found that when later years, in 74, 75, he would... He'd always seem to have girls around him,
you know? Mm-hmm.
And
right.
and it always bugged me the way he was touching them.
Hmm.
You know, it wasn't overtly sexual or anything like that, but it was definitely, to me, it was always creepy.
Hmm.
And I don't know why I thought that or anything like this. I just know that I felt it was. And my whole time in, I never heard of any of the sexual antics going on. But I always thought, I said something's going on, but I just can't quite pinpoint it. And
wow.
Of course, to talk about stuff like that would have been, you know, blasphemous.
Right, right. Well, I think also, I mean, one of the things I did when I got out of the way was I studied a lot about trauma. I mean, I went back to school and I was in therapy and learned a lot about sexual abuse. And when I was younger, I had experienced some violations. And so, and like one-third of adult women will have been sexually abused under the age of 18, which is a huge statistic. But So in a way, I was already numb to it, you know, so that when he patted me on the rear or, you know, not just a pat, it was like a smack on the rear, you know, like, hey there. I just didn't have that inner wiring that was... said it had already been that boundary had already been broken before in my younger life.
Yeah, it's a tough it's a tough thing when you realize that. I mean, I think it's a fairly common thing that the people that Werewolf abused had something in their background,
right?
That as you say, numbed them from the from the effect. Because, and you know, I think he sought them out vigorously.
Sure. Yeah. And that's what sexual predators do. I mean, there's actually a name for it. It's called sitting duck syndrome. Sitting duck syndrome. That as somebody, a child that's been abused will be much more likely in their adulthood to be re-abused than a kid that, you know, grew up fine and wasn't violated. And so, they see you coming. And he knew I was vulnerable, so. And it was almost as if I had been groomed from the time I first met him, because he did take me in as a father figure.
Yeah. Actually, reading it the second time, I can really see that, where there were just these signposts that were set out. Again, you may not have been able to see them, but they were there. You know, you could see that there was this man that was making his, you know, he was really good about the way he made advances. That was probably some of his reason for his success.
Right. It's just grooming.
Right.
You know, he was really grooming me and other people that it happened to.
So the last area we're going to go into is the Christian family and sex. Where we started, yeah. Again, that for me, that was a class where I was like going, I said, there's something wrong with this class. There's just something, you know.
You were still like plugged into reality.
I did. I constantly question things. You know, I mean, John Pope's thorn in the side for many months, because he would do these things and I would refuse to take the class. I was going, why can't I just buy the books and read it? And I, of course, would stand up at meetings and ask him that. And it's no wonder when I finally did take the class, he ripped up all my questions.
Oh my God. And you had what, like 5 pages of them?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, that's wild.
Now, I wasn't really clear. You had taught a Christian family and sex class or something?
Just to the little folks.
It was
at a Christian family and sex camp.
Oh, yeah.
We had camps, and so there was like Renewed Mind and then Christian family and sex. And so I was teaching the kids, but God help me if I know what version of Christian family and sex. It was just probably we taught them, you know, basic Bible stuff, and I don't remember getting into any sex stuff with them, because I, you know, that's the blind leading the blind. I wasn't that much older than them, to tell you the truth. What was I going to say? Hey, you know, this happens, you know. But so I remember there were a couple of times where I got sprung from having to teach, and I'd go down to the main teachings, and even I thought they were pretty far out.
Now, was he teaching it live, or was that on tape?
That was live.
That was live, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, a lot of bells went off. I don't know if it did for you, though, too.
Well, when I saw that movie with the two lesbians and the German Shepherd, that was... That kind of took the cake. I was like, well, it's nice of him to show us this, but God, it's so out of bounds, you know? I mean, he was like, well, I want to show you what devil spirits do to people, and it just seemed like overkill. It wasn't something that was, you know, it was almost like he was getting a charge out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't understand why he was showing it to us.
Yeah, that gets into the whole... You know, the trust issue that you have with somebody that's the man of God, you know, he must be doing it for a reason. There must be some reason that I just can't understand right now.
Exactly.
But I think that's as far in the book we're going to go to.
Okay.
Losing the Way will be out in June of this year. You can pre-order the book from Amazon. If you'd like a link, go to losingtheway.com, losingtheway.com. And there's a link there where you can pre-order the book. And we will be having more discussions as when the book comes out.